Thanks for downloading this episode of Cork Talk with me, Tim Atkin. A weekly conversation with some of the most famous people in the world of wine.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Nomacork by Vinventions. Driven by a commitment to innovation, the new plant-based Nomacork Green Line offers significant improvements in wine closure performance. Thanks to a rigorous oxygen ingress rate, you can decide which cork is best for your wine, whether it's for young and fresh wines or for those with aging potential.
The locals laugh when Dominic Huber made his first wines at Terroir Al Limit in Priorat, but he's proved them all wrong. Born in Germany, it was his dream to live close to the Mediterranean, and he's done just that, producing some of Spain's finest reds. I caught up with him on a welcome day of rain in Catalonia to talk about Garnacha and Carignana, slate and clay, what he learnt from South African Eben Sardi, and the exciting future of Spanish fine wines. Hello, Dominic. How are you? Welcome to the podcast.
I'm fantastic. Thanks so much, Tim. How are you?
I'm really well. Are you in Priorat?
No, I'm sitting at the beach at the moment. I'm looking at the rain.
The rain? There's not been much rain in Catalonia for ages, is there?
Yeah, but it is raining at the moment. We are very, very happy.
Yeah, because there have been all sorts of water restrictions, haven't there?
Oh, yes. It's a tough time at the moment.
Yeah. When did it last rain?
Well, it's raining always a bit. The problem is the quantities. It's just not really raining strong enough, you know?
Yeah.
But last night, it was raining the whole night in Priorat, so that's good news.
That's great news. I mean, we'll talk a little bit more about climate change later because I'm interested in that. But I just wanted to start with a bit of your background because people can probably hear you've got a bit of a German accent, but you're also, I think, half Italian, aren't you?
No, I'm not half Italian. I would love to be half Italian.
Wouldn't we all?
I'm 100% German. 100% German, yes.
Tell us a little bit about where you were brought up. Were you brought up in a wine region?
No, not at all. I was brought up in the south of Munich at the lakes, a very beautiful area. And my grandfather and my father, they were butchers. So there was a lot of food, foodies in the family.
Yeah.
So this is what led me to wine in the end.
And so were they wine lovers as well?
Not really, to be honest. They were drinking wine, but they were not wine lovers. No, I couldn't say so.
What would be your nearest wine region? It would be something like the Pfalz, would it?
Kind of, yes.
Yeah.
But I was not interested in wine and active in wine before I came to Priorat. First in London, obviously, and then when I came to Priorat, yes.
You were very interested in food. I mean, I've read somewhere you had a life-changing moment when you were, I think, 18 or something, in a trattoria, an Italian trattoria in Liguria. Tell us a little bit about that moment.
Well, my family has a very small house in the mountains in Liguria. And when we started going there the first time, I was 18 years old and I was sitting in a little trattoria and the antipasti came in one by one. And I was sitting there and I was so amazed about the quality and the ambience and the whole feeling of the place and the food that I decided, I said to myself, I would like to spend my life in the Mediterranean and not in Germany.
But you didn't want to be a butcher like your family had been before you.
No.
But did you want to be a chef?
I was thinking very, very seriously many times to become a chef, yes. Hmm.
But you didn't do it in the end.
I didn't do it in the end because I was working many, many years in restaurants as a waiter and also as a helper in the kitchen. And I realized that this is maybe the toughest job that you can choose.
It's pretty awful. I mean, there are worse jobs, I think, aren't there? You know, working in a slaughterhouse.
Of course, there's always worse. But I mean, being a chef is a real challenge.
Yeah,
physically,
I think it is.
Mentally, and also from the time shifts and altogether, I think it's a very tough. It's a very tough thing being a chef.
I agree with you. And it's why the chefs always look so tired. I mean, they never see the daylight half the time. Right? What did you do between that sort of eureka moment in Liguria and when you went to study at university? You did economics and marketing. You were in London, you were in Munich, you were in Madrid. And that wasn't until your late 20s. So what did you do between 18 and 27? Was that the stuff you were doing in restaurants?
I was studying. I was a bit a late studier because it took me some while to finish my A-levels. And then I did a sabbatical. I went to London. This is when I came the first time in contact with wine. I did the VSET studies, 2 degrees, and I fell in love with wine. I went back to Munich. I started my studies a bit later with 23 only. And then I finished with 4 years later with 27.
Yeah. And tell us a bit about that time in London. Did you start to get interested in the wine scene, not just doing the WSET qualifications?
Yes, of course. I mean, there was already a young wine scene happening, and I visited some of the wine bars. But there was not so much going on, to be very honest. And it was very, very expensive for us these days in London.
And then what about the time in Madrid? That was a part of your degree, was it?
Yes. This was a great city, but it was a very tough university. We had to study very, very hard, unfortunately. I'm a bit sad about that because I couldn't really live the life of Madrid that I know now.
Yeah. And you were studying in Spanish, presumably?
Yes, of course, which was tough.
So you speak English and German. Obviously, you speak very good English. You speak German because you're German. Bit of Italian? Do you speak a bit of Italian from the Liguria connection?
I speak Italian, yes. I do, absolutely. I love Italian and the country.
And then when did you finish in Madrid? How old were you when you finished your degree?
I think I was 26.
Yeah, okay. And then what made you think, I want to go into wine?
Well, for me, wine was always the connection to many, many beautiful things. There is the agriculture, there is the social part, there is the viticulture, the nature, and obviously the food. And I'm a really very enthusiastic foodie, and wine is part of it.
So you like to cook?
I love to cook, yes. I'm a very simple, very, very down-to-earth chef, but I like to buy good stuff. We have a beautiful market here nearby, so when you come one day, we can visit first the market together, which is half of the cooking.
Yeah.
And then you go and prepare it in a very honest, very simple way.
I mean, nothing better than that, don't you think? Just Mediterranean ingredients and
I think
simple
so.
Food.
I think so. Yeah. And in Spain, we have these wonderful products. We have enormously beautiful fish possibilities from the Mediterranean here. Mm. And then obviously also lots of great meat from Galicia, from everywhere around Spain. And the organic vegetable, there's a very beautiful place in Reus. Mm. So there's many, many possibilities to source wonderful stuff.
And what was it that took you to Priorat, which is where you've made your name? I mean, you ended up doing an internship at Mas Martinet. How did you end up there?
This is a complete coincidence. I wanted throughout my studies, I wanted to get better in Spanish and obviously learn about wine. Mm. And my father, he knew a wine merchant in Germany, Vinopolis, Mr. Pfeiffer, and he was the guy that introduced me to the Perez Ovejero family from Mas Martinet. Luckily.
And so why Priorat? Did you want to go to Priorat, or was it just because your father had a connection?
I didn't search or kind of look around Europe where to go. It was just an opportunity. I took my opportunity. I met the right people, and this is where I ended up.
Tell us a little bit about the Perez family, because they're very important in terms of the modern history of the region, aren't they?
Yes. Well, first of all, they're very human people. They have a great humanity. They're very intellectual people, very good people. I can't really say anything negative about them at all. Only the contrary. They treated me like their fifth son. And I always felt very, 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 very good in their house. And I think that's a big part of why I ended up in Priorat. José Luis Perez, Montse Perez, the parents, and then the four kids. Together with Adria Perez and Sara Perez, yes.
And what were you doing as an intern? Were you just doing the basic things in the cellar, like sort of emptying tanks? And were you picking as well?
Yes, of course. We were also picking. We were in the vineyards and in the cellar.
Mm. So that lasted, what, 1 year, did it? Or just a few months, I suppose?
Well, the first one was just a few months. Mm. But then I came back later after my studies for a whole year. Mm.
And then you actually got a job, didn't you? A full-time job with them.
Yes, I had a full-time job at Mas Martinet, yes.
Yeah. And did you already have an idea then you might make your own wine, or was that just in the future?
Well, sometimes in my dreams I was thinking about it, yes.
Yeah. So for a year you were working alongside them making their wines, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the region. I mean, I'll talk about how you started making your own wines in a while, but for anybody who's not been there, can you just tell us a little bit about Priorat in terms of its climate, its soil types, and maybe the little bit about the different villages?
Well, first of all, it's a terroir at the limit, you know? Mm. So there is no Giovanni, there's no Vespa, there's no cappuccino, no pizza, no pasta. It's not Tuscany. It's right the opposite. It's a very rough place. It's a very beautiful place. It's very archaic. Yeah. It has this wonderful mountain chain of Monsan Mountain and the nine villages, which are very picturesque and very romantic. But it's a tough place.
And what are the major climatic influences? It's presumably, how close are you to the ocean, for example, to the Mediterranean Sea, really?
We're about 30, 40 minutes drive to the ocean. And we have to influence from the inner Spain, obviously, also. So it's in between these two.
So it's continental and Mediterranean influences, really. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
And how many different villages are there within the Priorat denominación?
Nine. There's nine villages. There's villages from the very south of Priorat to the very north. They're stretching nine villages in these different valleys of Priorat. And there's two different soil types. If you look up in the books and you look for Priorat, you will always find only one soil type, which is the famous Licorella, the schist. But there's another soil type, which is the clay, the argile, which we are very happy about. And we are working quite a bit with, because you can make lighter and fresher wines. And you find them on the Serra de Montsant, which is a part of the Serra de Montsant, is the Ocu Priorat.
And presumably clay, it retains water better, which is very important given the drought, yeah?
Yes. Exactly,
yeah. And tell us a little bit about the differences between Montsant and Priorat, because Montsant sort of surrounds Priorat. What, on two sides or three sides?
Priorat is the blue chip, the famous brand, and Montsant is the cheap brother. This is what people think, and it's very, very unfair and it's very untrue, because Montsant has a huge potential that I see since we started our winery there. 5 years ago, it has different soil types. It has more different soil types, not just the schist. It has a lot of different microclimates, a lot of altitude sites, and it has a more liberal, open-minded DO. So you can do different things that you can't do in Priorat.
And is Montsant higher than most of Priorat or not?
Yes, most of Montsant is higher than Priorat, altitude-wise. Yeah.
So what would be the lowest point in Priorat and maybe the highest? How low does it go?
Well, it goes to, let's say, 200 meters, let's say. And it goes up to 800 meters.
Yeah. And presumably there are big differences between 200 and 800. You're going to get very different styles of wine, aren't you?
Yes, absolutely. You can see that with our Les Magnes, which is on 800 meters altitude. This is our highest vineyard that we have in Priorat. And then we have the Terra de Cuques, which is our village wines. They're made on 200, 300, 400 meters altitude.
And just how big is Priorat and how big is Montsant in terms of hectareage? Do you know roughly?
Well, it's 1,300 hectares in Priorat. And it's, I don't know exactly, but it's much bigger in Montsant.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the history of Priorat, because the vines were planted there, presumably by the Romans, were they, years ago. But it was also developed by the church, wasn't it? Monks, I think, from Burgundy.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. The Grand Chartreuse from Grenoble. These monks, they went down to the south of France and they were invited from the Catalan king into the region of Priorat. This is why it's called Priorat. And they kind of, the objective was to re-Christianize the area after they got rid of the Moors. So it was always this fight between the Moors and the Christians up and down in Spain. And when the Christians won, they got the monks in to re-Christianize the area, to establish the culture again, and they started with the wine growing.
Yeah, I mean, some of the monasteries are amazing, aren't they?
It's a one-hectare piece, and it's already impressive now. So imagine when there was no cars and no trucks and no machines and nothing and no cement. So it was a really impressive building. It's massive. It's wonderful. Yeah. It's very beautiful.
And Scala Dei is an amazing building because it's one of those beautiful buildings I know. Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Do we know what, I mean, the monks were obviously planted grapes. Do we know what they were growing back then? Would it have been Grenache?
They were not only growing, obviously, Grenache and Carignan. There was a lot of other stuff. But to be honest, I don't know these grape varieties.
I wonder if anybody knows. Do you think they do? I mean, it could have been.
Paris knows quite a bit about all that.
Hmm. So it could have been Pinot Noir or something like that, do we think?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I really doubt that.
Yeah. Listen, you've mentioned Grenache and you mentioned Carignan or Carignana. Those are the two dominant grape varieties in the region, aren't they?
Well, unfortunately, there's still a bit of Cabernet Sauvignon left, because when the reset happened with the father of René Barbier, the man that had the great vision and that we own so much in the region, thanks to his vision of making fine wine in Priorat, we are all around there, because he is a very generous man, and he had this idea of sharing. So inviting his best friends like Daphne Glorian, Alvaro Palacios, José Luis Pérez. So he invited a bunch of people into Priorat to make together this dream come true.
And they made one wine together, didn't they?
They made one wine together. They bottled it under different labels. And then everybody already kind of spread out and looked for their own reality.
Yeah. And he told me a very funny story. He said that they had one wine and they bottled it under different labels, and the wine got different reviews under different labels.
Right? It's very funny.
it's a sad comment on wine journalists, really, isn't it?
That's the worst what can happen to a wine journalist.
I think so. Tell us the difference between Carignan or Carignana and Garnacha, these two essential grapes, really, as far as Priorat is concerned. What are they like to grow?
Well, for me, maybe this is a bit a historic way of explaining things, and maybe not very politically correct. But for me, the Carignan has a bit this masculine side of the backbone, the structure, the acidity, the freshness, and the Grenache is more this feminine, beautiful fruit. I think it's a great match. They fit very well together. And we are very happy with our Terra de Cuques, where we have both grape varieties blended together.
Are most Priorat wines blends of more than one grape then?
Not necessarily. There's also more and more single vineyards.
Focused on one single grape variety?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Just tell me whether you treat them differently in the vineyard and also in the winery, these two different grape varieties.
Yes, of course. They ripen much faster, the Grenaches, than the Carignans, and also they need a bit more care. The Carignan is more sensitive, the very thin skin, and you have to be careful. And in the winery, we extract a bit more the Carignans than the Grenaches.
Okay, so but you're saying Carignan is more fragile, is it, in a way?
Yes, it is.
Hmm. I mean, Garnacha is quite robust. I mean, it's a very Mediterranean grape variety, isn't it? Well, so is Carignan, I suppose.
Yes.
Yeah. You farm biodynamically, I think, don't you? Just tell us a little bit about that, when you started doing that.
We started doing that about 8 to 10 years ago. And I went to Dornach, to the place where Rudolf Steiner was teaching. And I was a bit shocked because I saw the whole operation also going a bit into the direction of a sect a bit, you know. So I was taking the stuff that I think is very good for the land and for the winery. But I wouldn't call myself a hardcore 100% biodynamic farmer.
Dornach is in Austria, is it, presumably?
It's in Austria, yes.
Yeah. So what did you do? You went there for a stage or something?
For a seminar.
A seminar. It's interesting. I just wondered, do you think that growing biodynamically, and some people say this, means that the vineyards can cope better with climate change and this very extreme climate you've talked about?
I think so. I think that this is a good way of coping with global warming. But in the very end, to be very honest, if you have a lack of water, which is happening now, and the temperatures are going up and up, it's gonna be tough for the moment. The old vineyards are still hanging very well. They're doing well. But I'm very happy that it was raining last night, I have to say. We were very nervous, very, very nervous.
And what other things can you do to deal with climate change? I mean, obviously, in terms of viticulture, yeah?
Luckily, what we did already, we had that vision already 20 years ago. So when we arrived to Priorat, Eben Sadi and myself, we in these days already were looking for high altitude and northern facing sites.
Yeah.
This is the most important that you can do. When you're sitting in Kratajobs in a south facing site in the last 2 years, it was very difficult. If you're sitting in Torosha or Porera in a north facing high altitude site,
yeah,
it's a very, very different situation.
Yeah, interesting. You mentioned Eben Sadi, and many of the people listening to this podcast will know who Eben is. He's probably the most famous winemaker in South Africa. He was your partner in Tewarla Limit for, I think, 11 years. Just tell us how the two of you met.
That was a very funny story. We met by coincidence harvesting, the two of us, in one of the vineyards of Mas Martinet. I came from one side of the vineyard and he came from the other side of the vineyard. And I just later on, Sarah told me that she picked him up that very morning from the airport. And as I was the only guy speaking proper English in the working force in the picking team, we immediately met and we started conversation and we became friends and we started a project together and we had a wonderful 10 years together, 11 years together.
And what was he doing there? He just come to do a harvest, did he?
Well, he was tasting Priorat wines in London and he got very curious about the personality, about the character of the wines, and he wanted to learn more about it.
And so how did you decide to do, when did you decide to do a business together? Was that?
He invited me twice to South Africa to do the harvest there.
Yeah.
And this is where we met better and where we understood better our different characters and interests. And we realized that we go well on with each other, that we are sharing many values. Mm. And that was the moment when we started to make wine together.
And do you have a similar approach to wine? I mean, Eben is very low intervention in a way, isn't he? I mean, very fine wines.
Yes, absolutely. We were very similar to that. And he taught me a lot about winemaking and I taught him quite a bit about cooking and food understanding and the Priorat. So it was a perfect match.
So he's a better cook because of you and you're a better winemaker because of him.
Exactly.
So how did you choose the name, Terroir à la Limite? You've mentioned this idea in a sense, but what does it signify?
Well, to be honest, there is a lot of frustration behind that name also, not just a funny, interesting name. There's also the frustration of not having internet, the frustration of all the curves and turns, the heat, the drought, the bad coffee, the warm beer. It's a tough place. It's a tough place. It's a terroir at the limit. It's a place where it's not easy to make something happen.
Yeah. And historically, was it very poor, Priorat?
It's the poorest region of Catalonia, yes.
Yeah. And it had been semi-abandoned, really, hadn't it?
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. When I came to Priorat, there was still some mules on the streets.
There were still some what?
Mules on the streets.
Oh, mules, right. Yes. I think it's famous for only having one traffic light, isn't it, the entire region?
No, there's no traffic light, actually.
No, there's no traffic lights in Priorat at all.
Which is wonderful.
No, it is. I envy you that. But there were mules, what? People were just still riding mules or using mules to transport stuff?
Well, there was, when I came to Torosha the first time, there was still a guy in the village. He had a mule and his remolque, his how do you call that? He was having something behind the mule.
Yeah, yeah.
He was transporting his stuff.
And he was pulling it along. Yeah.
Yes.
It's interesting. I mean, from the start, the two of you, this is you and Evan, you set out to make a very different, elegant style of Priorat. You know, what inspired that style? I mean, I know that food is part of your, as you said, your obsession. And I like eating with you because you're thinking about the food as well as the wine. What inspired the styles of wine you wanted to make?
Well, I think there was always I would call it open-minded and modern vision towards lighter style, also tasting other great wines of the world, obviously.
Mm. And particularly from where?
Well, from Italy, from France, from a bit from everywhere.
Burgundy being an inspiration, maybe?
Of course, yes.
Yeah, and then Barolo or what?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And what did people say when you started to make those wines for the first time? When was your first release?
You know, in the beginning, they laughed.
They laughed?
They laughed. Then they got angry, and then they had to admit that maybe we had chosen a good direction.
Yeah. And why did they get angry, do you think?
Well, because they realized that we might become a competition.
Yeah. Was it difficult being two foreigners making wine there?
When we started to make good wine and when we started to make a bit more of it, it was not always easy, no.
So once you started to win awards and get press mentions and notice, it made it difficult, did it?
Yeah, exactly.
And what about now? Are you accepted better by them, do you think, 10 years on?
I think so, yes, absolutely.
Mm. What's changed, do you think?
Well, I think the people are intelligent, and the people are reading what's going on, and they realize that things are changing drastically and very, very rapidly, and that Priorat as such also has to change. And Priorat is changing, and Priorat has been changing already quite a bit.
And is there a new generation of Priorat winemakers that's doing that? Because the original generation was 89, wasn't it, really? And that's a lot of those. Alvarez still around, obviously, Palacios. But.
Well, for example, Mas Martinet is a very good example. There is the father, José Luis Pérez, and his wife, Montse. Let's kind of call them the founding generation, obviously. And then there is Sara Pérez, together with her husband, René Barbier, which is the son of René Barbier's father, second generation. And it's a huge difference, obviously, how they see Priorat, how they see the world of wine, how they act, how they communicate, and their values and their action.
And they're much more international in outlook, aren't they? I mean, we've had dinner with them and they love wines from elsewhere. They're like you. They drink Burgundy and Barolo and all sorts of stuff, really.
Yes, exactly.
And I love the fact that that Sarah and René are married, and that they're the children of two of the sort of half a dozen founders of modern Priorat, really, in 1989, aren't they?
And they have four children. So imagine the estate is in good hands.
Yeah, that's good to hear. Both estates, right?
Yes. Well, they have there is Clos Mogador, there is Mas Martinet, and there's also Universal. The Monsan project.
Yeah, exactly.
And many, many side projects that they're doing. They're highly creative.
Tell us a little bit about your ranges, because you started, I think, with just one wine that you made with Eamon, didn't you? And how many do you make now, and what are the different levels, really, that you're producing?
Well, we have the seven wines. The most important is the Domaine, the seven wines of the Domaine, which goes from Village, Terra de Cuques, red and white, to Premier Cru, Abosa, Ditz del Terra, north-facing, south-facing, 100% Carignan, Pedra de Guiche, Premier Cru also, our white, the old vineyards of Terroir Limite. And then we have the Grand Crus, which is Magnes and Tosses, the Grenache, Garnacha Peluda, Magnes, and the 100% Carignan, the Tosses. This is the main brand. This is the most important what we are doing.
Tell us a little bit about the white quickly, because I mean, Priorat is mostly red, isn't it? But what percentage of the region would be white wines?
A few years ago, there was 5% of white. I think there had been quite a bit of planting now. I think now it's more, but it's definitely not more than 10%. So it's nothing. It's a very small amount. But we are very, very successful with our white wines.
And what are the grape varieties? Presumably Grenache Blanc, Garnacha Blanca, right?
Only with Grenache Blanc, Macabeo, and Pedro Ximénez.
Yeah. Garnacha Gris would not work there, would it?
It's not allowed, no.
Okay, yeah. Yes. And also, while we're on Grenache, could just tell us a bit more about Garnacha Peluda, you mentioned, which is the grape variety that's planted in Les Magnes, which is your best wine.
Well, we were very lucky to find that vineyard a few years ago. There's a beautiful story to it, because we found it sitting in a little bar in Scala Dei in the village, and we were eating lamb chops. And Evan jumped up because a tractor came, drove by, and he said, "Oh, can you see this? Evan is colorblind. He has, he's colorblind." So he very often in the morning, he said, "Oh, Dominic, you're wearing a beautiful blue shirt," and it was green. So I knew that already. So when he said, "Dominic, can you see these wonderful blue grapes?" I was saying, yes, I can. And he was very excited about it. And we stopped the tractor driver. He was very excited about it. And we started eating the grapes from the trailer. And what you feel when you drink the wine, the spiciness, this American spice market aromatics, like rose petals and the skin of the mandarin and all that, we had that in our mouth when we were eating the grapes these days. And we convinced the tractor driver to tell us where the grapes are from. And we called the guy, and we managed in 2004 to get already the first 1,000 kilos of Garnacha Peluda from Les Magnes.
And did you buy the vineyard?
Later on, I was able to buy the vineyard, yes. And this is also the reason why we are making wine in Monsanto, because with the vineyard of Masdeo came another vineyard called Montals, just a few hundred meters down the road, but in the old Monsanto.
Yeah, interesting. So Eben was right about the flavors and the aromas, but wrong about the color. He's wrong about the color, right?
Well, sometimes.
He was right about that color, was he?
Important was the flavor, not the color.
Exactly. I mean, Priorat is run along Burgundian lines in a way, you know, regional, village and cru, Premier Cru and Grand Cru wines. How did that develop? And has it been a good thing, do you think, for the image of the region?
I think it's a very good thing for the region. I think it makes sense to use a system that is easy understandable by the people and which is already established. And I think it's fantastic for the region, yes.
And so who decides if something is a Grand Cru or a Premier Cru? Is there like a tasting panel?
There's a tasting panel of the DOQ, yes.
Okay. So you can't just say this is a Grand Cru. Somebody's got to agree with you.
Well, they don't call it Grand Cru. They call it Vie de Villa, which is the village level. And then they have the Vie de Paraje and they have the Viña Calificada y Gran Viña Calificada. So it's not actually the same thing. They invented their own names.
Yeah.
And terroir limit is not part of that system.
Oh, you don't use the system. So you can't call...
No, we don't use the Priorat system. We use the generic Burgundy system.
So can you put Grand Cru on the label?
No, of course not. That's a French protected terminus.
Yeah, they'd get very upset, wouldn't they?
Of course.
And how many different single parcel wines do you make?
We make 3-5 single parcels.
And just tell us the differences between them.
Well, we have Abosa, which is the 100% Carignan, but this is north-facing. So this is on top of the village of Torroja. North-facing, very beautiful, 108-year-old vineyard. Then we have Ditz del Terra. Ditz del Terra is in the valley of Torroja towards Gratallops. That's a very warm vineyard. That's a south-facing vineyard. Then we have 3 very small vineyards that we blend together in the case of the Pedra de Guiche. That's a Grenache, a Macabeo, and a Pedro Jimenez site. Very old wines, between 60 and 90 years old. And then we have 2 wonderful vineyards, one in the Sierra de Montsant on the part of Priorat, which is called Mas Deo. And there we make the Les Magnes, Garnacha Peluda, on 800 meters altitude in clay soil. That's very important. That's a completely different soil type also. And then to end up, we have the Les Tosses on schist, Licurella, on 650 meters altitude in Torroja del Priorat.
And Les Magnes, which you've mentioned, the story of you tasting the grapes, you know, would that be the highest vineyard in Priorat? One of them, certainly, wouldn't it?
Yes, this is one of the highest vineyards.
Yeah. And most of the high vineyards presumably face south, do they?
Yes.
Yeah. Whereas this is north. That's what makes it such a special wine, isn't it? It really is.
Okay.
And in Fint and Kerr's recent Catalunya report for my site, it was the red wine of the year, which is fantastic news, I think.
Well, thanks so much for that again. Yeah, we were very happy.
Good. I hope you've sold out.
It's all gone.
Good. I managed to buy 6 bottles. I'm delighted I managed to get 6 bottles.
Well, thanks so much.
Yeah. Tell us a bit more about the region, because Priorat, in many ways, we've talked about this as an old wine region, you know, that monastic connection, but it's also very new. You know, 1989, we've mentioned the wine that René and that group of people made. Again, do you think that the fact that it's quite new is a positive thing? Does it mean that there's less historical baggage than a region like, I don't know, Rioja might have? I mean, Ribera is a similar region in that it's both old but quite new, and that the DO is still for, you know, 1982, really. Has that been a good thing for you, that you've been able to innovate as a region?
Well, I think there's 2 sides to that topic. I think on the one hand, it's great if you can renovate something easily and you break with the past in a certain way. On the other hand, it's also beautiful to have tradition and history. So I think there's 2 sides. It's like in Italy, where you have Piemonte on the one hand, like the traditional historic place, and then you have Maremma, the super Tuscans, on the other hand, in the southern Tuscany area, where they started from scratch something completely new.
Yeah,
it has opportunities. It gives you freedom of movement. But I like also the historic approach very much, to be honest.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your wife, Tatiana, because she's or your partner, rather, who's also the winemaker, right? So you guys work alongside each other. She's Serbian, I think, and used to be a bit of a dancer. How did you guys meet and start making wine together?
Well, I got a call from a friend of mine, a biodynamic consultant from Germany, and he asked me if we need some estagiaires, some wine students for the harvest. This was 8 years ago. And he was talking a bit about Tatjana being a very hardworking Serbian lady. And I always like having young people around in the winery because I like this international culture. I think young people, they ask a lot of very interesting questions that make you reflect. And I like that culture. We always have that in the cellar. We always have 3 to 5 young people from all around the world. And we started with South African guys and then all around the world. And yeah, she came 7, 8 years ago and we met and she did a great job in the winery. And yeah, we became partners and we have a beautiful daughter together now.
And she's never left.
And she's never left. Yeah, she left in between for 2 years to Switzerland.
Yeah.
But then she came back.
Yeah. I want to talk to you a little bit about the fine wine scene in Spain, because I think one of the things you've been quite bold with is in your pricing. You know, the wines are fantastic and I think world class, but your top wines, you're asking quite high prices for them. Spain, it seems to me, is finally developing the reputation it deserves as a fine wine producing country. How can it build on that? What does it need to do to get rid of the cheap and cheerful image, as we would say in English?
I think it's very interesting. There is some big family-owned winemaking businesses in Catalonia, but also in the rest of Spain, and they're really having trouble now to sell all their wines. Mm. And there's more and more young producers coming up all around Spain making beautiful stuff, and they're quite successful. So I think we're in a really very good dynamic moment for the world of wine, not just for Spain, but also for the consumer. Because there's all these wonderful historic vineyards around Spain, which allow us to make a beautiful wine. I think Spain is in a great moment when it comes to that. And it's the combination also of the kitchen. I think it's the cuisine, also the gastronomical aspect that helps Spain a lot. I mean, everything started with El Bulli, you know. El Bulli put Spain back on the map culturally. More than anything else.
Yeah, because it was the greatest restaurant in the world, you know, according to...
It was the greatest restaurant in the world and everybody wanted to go there. And then slowly, surely, the whole gastronomy changed and then also the wine world changed. And for me, and I'm a bit extreme in that, I think for me, wine and food is so, so, so connected. It has to be connected. And Spain is showing that in a very beautiful way, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I mean, it's probably one of the great food and wine cultures of the world, I think.
Of course, together with Italy and obviously France. But now the new world is also coming. There is Peru becoming more and more. The Argentina, Chile. Well, it's happening.
And South Africa.
South Africa, yes. That's very true.
Tell us a little bit about how you get away from wine. You've got a young daughter, obviously. But do you still like to cook? How do you relax?
Well, cooking is one of the most important parts and the nature. I love to be at the sea. I love to be in the mountains. I love to go to San Sebastian. I'm an addicted traveler. I love to sit in my car and drive somewhere. This is the best way of relaxing for me with the family.
So you drive where? To the coast? You're on the coast now, obviously, but you like to drive up to San Sebastian as well?
I love to drive to San Sebastian, yes.
Yeah. And is it still raining outside?
It is still raining outside. Yes, it is still raining outside. That's good. Wonderful news.
Well, I think that's the best news I've heard. I don't believe in God, but anyway, let's pray for rain in a sunny kind of way. Maybe we do a rain dance, shall we?
We should do a rain dance, yeah. Not praying, but dancing.
Okay. I like that idea. Let's dance. Next time I see you, we're going to catch up soon. We're going to drink some great wines, a little bit of a dance for some more rain. Dominic, it's been great talking to you. Thank you much for sharing. It's such an amazing story and inspirational, really, that, you know, you didn't really get into wine until what? Into your late 20s, really?
Yes. Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you, my friend. Good to talk to you and I'll see you soon.
Thanks so much, Tim. It was wonderful. All the best. Thanks so much. Take care.
What a fascinating chat. And I love that story about how Dominic and Eben discovered Les Magnus. Next week on Cork Talk, my guest is the wine industry legend Tony Lathwaite of Lathwaite's Wine. Join me then. Thanks for listening to Cork Talk. If you want to read more reports, articles and tasting notes by me, go to my website, timatkin.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @timatkin, and on Instagram, @timatkinmw. See you next week.